This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Into another world. Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good it just has to be fattening, right here on filmschoolrejects.com. I'm Brian, that's Cargill, and if you aren't aware of what this show is, I invite you to take a little trip down digital memory lane with iTunes and Stitcher, our entire back catalog. Check it out. If you dig what we're doing, definitely follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like what we do here with our irony-free appreciation of the films that have been long forgotten for one reason or another, please consider pledging to our Patreon, which is just patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, because that is literally how we keep the lights on here, and we very much appreciate your pledges.
And it's got a bit of extra content.
Oh yeah,
it's supersizing your junk food.
Yeah, see what we did there? Do you see that? Do you see the kind of comedy you're missing out on by not being a patron?
High grade comedy.
High grade for all the low brows. So definitely check that out. And we will continue to post bonus content just for patrons. And again, thank you so much for doing that. In fact, I want to give a shout out to one recent patron at the $10 level, Mr. Ron Taylor. Thank you so much for becoming a patron.
Thanks, Ron.
You are hereby promoted to private first class in Megaforce. I have decreed it. There are no ranks in Megaforce, but
only the commander can give a rank in Megaforce. All right.
Well, you're not the commander either. You're just a lieutenant. So
I'm just a lieutenant.
We'll work our way up to that. We will get there, folks. We will get there. But in the meantime, I am so excited about this week's episode because
you're excited. I'm excited for this week's episode
because I got to do something for this episode that is the sole reason this show exists in the first place. The reason that I moved to Austin was that I got to see a movie that I really knew very little about. And as soon as I put it into my eyeballs, this refreshing wave of joy just poured over me. And I was like, yes, this is everything that I want in films. And we're continuing One Junkie Summer with this week's film. Cargill, tell us a little bit about this week's film.
This week's film is Vamp.
Vamp!
My day didn't start off too well. And then it got worse.
God, you look awful. What happened to you?
I was nearly hung. I got into a fight with a psychotic albino. I hit a cockroach, my best friend disappeared, and then I'm nearly assassinated by a runaway elevator.
Anyone can have an off night?
Vamp, a comedy with bite. And of course, Grace Jones.
Which is, this is one of those that when we were sitting here and I first thought of One Junkie Summer, this was one of those at the top of the list that I definitely wanted to do and was shocked to hear that you hadn't seen it.
Yeah, it's one I had only ever seen. I think I'd seen the trailer once and it had been sitting around your living room for years. This should have tipped me right away that it was going to be something special because it was in this DVD like six pack that was,
I got like 10 years ago.
It was released by Anchor Bay and it was released literally as a six pack of movies. Like the box art is just like if every movie is own beer. Yeah. And it's Vamp, it's Transylvania 65,000, it's Sleepaway Camp,
Elvira,
Mistress of the Dark,
Return of the High, and
Return of the Killer Tomatoes. Yeah, so
is why I was interested in it. I was like, holy shit, Return of the Killer Tomatoes. That was the only way to get it when Anchor Bay released it, was to buy it as part of the six pack. And they were just like, we'll get a bunch of these movies that we love that nobody fucking buys and put them out. And then, of course, Sleepaway Camp has gained a lot of acceptance over the last decade, you know, thanks to several of the critics, particularly like Eric Vespi, who have been championing that and showing it to anyone who will watch it. And then, of course, the Draft House showing it several times. And that's kind of made a comeback. But several of these other films have been mostly forgotten. And we've talked about many of them on this show now. Like, this six pack has wormed its way into the show. So, like, we haven't, I don't think we've talked Transylvania 6-5000 yet.
No.
And we probably won't ever talk Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, although it might happen.
It could definitely happen.
But now, here we are. We talked about Return to Horror High. We've talked about Sleepaway Camp. We've talked about Return of the Killer Tomatoes. Now it's time for fucking Vamp.
Yeah.
The Grace Jones starring, but not actually speaking, horror movie from 1986 that I saw in a fucking theater about two guys who go to a strip club to try to hire a dancer for a frat party, only to discover that it is entirely run by vampires and their thralls.
Now hold on a second, Cargill. You said a strip club where it turns out the strippers are vampires. Now, call me crazy. Maybe I'm having a Leonard moment here from Memento, but that sounds awfully familiar. Why does that concept sound familiar?
Because in January was the 20th anniversary of a little film called From Dusk Till Dawn.
Now, we would never, because our lawyers won't allow it, proclaim plagiarism on this show or insinuate, cast aspersions that filmmakers ripped off each other. But come on, Rodriguez must have been a fan of this movie.
I have no doubt. In fact, I'm willing to bet that because I think it was Quentin who wrote the script.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
And Quentin would know this because when he was working at a video store, Vamp was out.
Yeah.
You know, that was something that would have been on the shelf. And I'm willing to bet Quentin was probably sitting there at some point going, you know, it would be cool. Like, I love Vamp, but like, what if a bunch of criminals got held up and had to hole up in that club one night? Like, what would happen? Like, instead of frat boys, what if it were actual, like, violent fucking criminals who could actually defend themselves? What would that be like? What if it was Assault on Precinct 13 set in the club from Vamp? And then, of course, you know, the Rodriguez aesthetic was added to it, and it became a fucking amazing movie. Believe me. There is, if anyone out there thinks that there is a person sitting in this room that does not fucking love the shit out of From Dusk Till Dawn, you are fucking wrong. But Vamp, yes, predates it by 10 whole years.
Yeah.
But Vamp does this very differently.
And that's actually what I like. I like this movie a lot more than From Dusk Till Dawn, because I feel like where From Dusk Till Dawn is half of a really interesting, like, neo Sam Peckinpah crime film, and half just like a batshit insane, almost trauma level violent vampire film. Vamp is, I think the way that I tried to compartmentalize it in my head was Vamp is Night of the Creeps meets After Hours. It's if you took a vampire story and gave it to Jim Jarmusch, what would that look like? Because this whole movie takes place.
I think there is one. But.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Prior to Only Lovers Left Alive. Was that the name of it?
Yeah.
Okay. Prior to that, what would it have looked like if you had handed, you know, Jim Jarmusch a vampire film?
In this particular era.
Yeah.
That's the thing is that visual aesthetic, that's not unfair. And I love that you went to After Hours, because that is, I hadn't ever really put that together, but yeah, the minute sun goes down and that part of town clears the fuck out.
Yeah.
And they're kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
That is very much what it is.
There's literally a shot where he's walking down an alley and these headlights come on and it's a garbage truck coming after him that's so reminiscent of the Mr. Whipple van or whatever that Catherine O'Hara is driving in After Hours. It just, like, there's so much about the comedy of this sort of you know, the errors, the bad luck that follows you around all night, and sort of this farcical attempt to just get out of wherever you are that feels, and of course, taking place all over the course of one evening, like, there's just very much structurally that feels like After Hours. And yet, the movie begins with a, which I really liked the beginning of this movie, and I'm almost sorry to spoil it. So please, I hope you've watched this before.
Yeah, but this is one of those episodes where if you're listening to us to see if maybe you should see it.
Yeah, see it.
Listen to this enthusiasm here. There is no nostalgia here for Brian whatsoever to make him love. He picked up this movie and I started getting texts immediately. And 10 minutes in, he's like, oh my God, we have to cover this movie. I was like, yeah, let's see how it pans out. And then, of course, come to find out he did absolutely love it. So pause here.
Yeah.
Watch Vamp. And then come back and chat with us about it. Because this really is a special movie that is something unique and only could have existed in the summer of 1986.
Yeah.
So pause now and we're off.
Welcome back. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie. Now listen, so this movie starts with it starts with a church with people in robes, a lot of choral singing. It's just very heavy stuff. And then you go up to this tower and there's someone hanging in one of the stained glass windows. It's like, oh, this must be one of those vampire stories that starts, you know, in an ancient setting. And that makes sense. I've seen that plenty of times. Come to find out, it's a frat initiation. And it's so well done the way that it's revealed. It's very comical, but starts off pretty heavy and establishing this imagery that is very startling. And then when the joke is revealed, when the curtain is pulled back, I think it works all the better. And you have two guys who are trying to pledge this frat who, so again, Night of the Creeps similarity very strong here, because you have, you know, like the two guys at the beginning of Night of the Creeps are trying to get into the most popular frat on campus. The difference with these two, the difference with our heroes in Vamp, Keith and AJ, is that they're not as hapless dorky as the characters in Night of the Creeps.
No, they're kind of slick turbo douches.
They're turbo douches. They're con men. They're like two Tom Cruises from Rain Man. You know, like just a pair of Tom Cruises from Rain Man. And they actually turn the tables on the frat, and they're like, you know, we're not really feeling this. Like this whole fake hanging thing. I mean, I think you guys can do better. And actually convince the frat that, oh, you're having a party tonight. I tell you what, instead of doing all this initiation garbage, we'll get you whatever party favors you need. You let us in the frat. So, of course, the thing the douchebag frat wants is a stripper. So they set off on a quest to find a stripper, knowing that the first thing they're going to need is transportation. So they go to the rich, actual hapless dork student on campus, played by Getty Watanabe, Long Duck Dong himself. And the three of them, and that character is so desperate for friendship that he's like, yeah, let's do it. You guys have to take me with you though and pretend to be my friends for a week. But yeah, here's a car. We'll go to this place. And they find an ad in the paper for the After Dark Club, where, you know, there's this really crazy strippers are supposed to be. And they think, okay, that's the one we're going to go to. That is our setting. That is the majority of the movie spent inside this. I mean, it's kind of a one set piece movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a small scenes in the surrounding area, but
film that we get out of the club again.
Yeah.
And it's never boring.
No. And that's really surprising, because inside the club itself, I mean, if you think about that scene in From Dusk Till Dawn, there is actually a certain amount of production value made to make that building very elaborate.
Yes.
To make it very...
That strip club, the Titty Twister, doesn't look like any building you've ever been in your life.
And that pays off at the end, because it's revealed to be an Aztec temple.
But this looks like every low-rent fucking strip club you've ever been in your life.
There is nothing visually stimulating about this club unless you're just really into fuchsia. Like, if you really like the combination of purple and green lights.
Well, first of all, that is one of the... I was going to get to this. That is one of those things that is so very 1986.
Absolutely. Like,
there are a couple movies in this era where they are just filled. And we're going to be talking about them all summer. This was the summer of pink and green gels, and you would juxtapose that on screen, and like there's this one great shot that is so like almost so early 90s Batman.
I was just going to say,
like, where
that is
one
so
building,
funny.
One building is completely lit with green, powerful green gels, and the building next to it is powerful pink gels, and the character is standing in the foreground lit normally, and it's just like, and it looks fucking cool, and it looks so very of this time. This is, if those of you who are longtime listeners will remember that I was talking about what was going on with Nomads. Which Nomads was released earlier in this particular year, in 86. And I talked about how there was this kind of lighting that was only happened for about a year and a half, 2 years, where it was cool. And then everybody got burnt out on it. And the next thing, the next wave of thing that cutting edge Hollywood directors were burning out right after that lighting effect was fucking pink and green.
Yeah.
And this movie is loaded with it. And it's, but the thing is it's shot really well.
It is.
And it looks fucking cool. It's so dated, but it's dated in a really hip kind of fucking way.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned early 90s Batman, because the whole time I'm watching this movie, it looks like, the way it's lit, it looks like you're seeing the world through the only two color rods and cones in Joel Schumacher's eyes that still work, because everything is just green and purple, green and purple, green and purple everywhere.
Black and yellow, black but and it's, yellow, yeah. Black and yellow,
it's,
black and yellow.
It's 1986 Wiz Khalifa. You know what it is. Yeah, but you're right. It is actually, this movie, because it is so, it's definitely low budget. It's definitely, you know, a B movie all around, but it's given the care and taken with enough care that shots are really well constructed. And even when you're dealing with a location that isn't very visually interesting, they still find angles and they find things for extras to be doing. And they find all these like almost vaudevillian running comedy beats.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so startling how much this movie has going for it.
And on top of that, how smart the undercurrent of the movie is. There is a whole running bit of things that happen in this movie. And this is one of the things I really, truly respect and love about this movie, where there are, this is a movie that totally exists knowing that the audience understands the rules of vampires.
Yes.
So they don't explain them. Like, they do not spend time explaining to you what the fuck a vampire is.
There's literally a line in the movie, and this is so good, where one of the characters, as he's dying, says, you know, drag the coffins into the sunlight. At, you know what? You know how to kill a vampire. Yeah. And then dies.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's these moments that don't, that that would make sense in any other movie, but makes so much sense here. Just small little moments, like when people go into the bathroom, they go to wash their hands and they go to look in the mirror, and there's the mirror's no gone mirror. and they're like oh fuck, because it's a cheap bullshit bathroom. And you as a vampire fan is like, ah, there are no mirrors in this fucking club.
Yeah.
And the movie is full of those moments where while you're watching it, you're like, oh, this is exactly the type of place a vampire would be in that would not send up any red flags. Like, it's really cool how it's done. It's really fascinating. And there's just a couple of these moments scattered throughout the movie where you're just like, that's so smart. Other movies would try to lean in on that and go, huh? Huh? And Vamp is like, no, they get it. And if you don't get it, then okay. But you get it.
Yeah.
Because at this point in history, you've seen enough fucking vampire movies. We don't have to tell you. This is what's so great, is that this comes right before, in pop culture, comes right before Near Dark, which is the ultimate in, fuck you, you know what a vampire is. We're not even going to use the word vampire. Vampire movies.
Yeah.
And I feel like these two together are very much of this era of, like, we don't have to explain it anymore, which is something that doesn't exist now. Now we need to know the rules. We need to figure this out. You know, even when we talked about what we talked about last week with the night.
Fright Night.
Fright Night even has to explain the rules at certain points.
Yeah.
Of our vampires. And this movie never bothers to do that.
No. And in fact, it's interesting that, I mean, it's going to sound entirely pretentious to use an Aaron Sorkin quote when talking about Vamp, but based on what we were just talking about, I think it rings true where he said, Aaron Sorkin said, the biggest crime you could commit as a screenwriter is telling the audience something they already know. And I feel like that's something this movie really adeptly steps around, is ever having to explain anything to the audience as far as the vampire lore or, you know, they don't even go into it. So during the course of them visiting the strip club, they are introduced to Katrina, played by Grace Jones, in just, you know, if you've ever wanted to see what it would look like if prop comedian Carrot Top had his own burlesque show, I invite you to take a look at the makeup and hairstyle chosen for Grace Jones in her opening act, which again feels very much like that Selma Hayek moment where it's like everything stops and it's very like artistic and very, you know, kind of counter to just a traditional strip act. Now, this is actually something I wanted to talk about during the course of this. I don't want to phrase it in such a way as to say, you know, because Grace Jones is a mainstay of the 80s and for a while was considered a sex symbol. And instead of asking the question, which I feel is a little tasteless, of saying, is Grace Jones attractive? I prefer to think of it as, did you ever find Grace Jones attractive?
Well, yeah. The thing to keep in mind about Grace Jones is that Grace Jones was one of the great counterculture figures of the mid-80s. She was very avant-garde. She was the high end of avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have this this incredibly alluring, exotic woman. Exotic is the best way to describe
sure.
it, because, and not in the polite way of saying, you know, she's from of another ethnicity. I mean, just fucking exotic. Like, she was just, her art was bonkers. Her music was even more bonkers than her art, because she was also, you know, a musician. She was performing. There's actually a few of her music videos you can see on Night Flight, because Night Flight loved her. And in the mid-80s, she was just weird and cool and dated Dolph Lundgren. And they, you know, she would go to art museum openings and made a big thing about just the avant-garde nature of art. And so she was really strange. So, of course, her stripping act in this movie is going to be fucking bonkers weird.
Yeah.
And it's so Grace Jones. It's amazing.
But it's weird. Like, I have never, like, I've seen Grace Jones in movies and, you know, TV
like
appearances.
Conan the Destroyer.
Like Conan the Destroyer, like A View to a Kill, and like something I watched a lot when I was a kid, which was the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special, where she shows up as like a special guest, and it's just like I've never understood it. Like I get what you're, like, the avant-garde thing makes a lot of sense, because being out there, if that's her thing, she got to go full Grace Jones in this movie.
Because, oh, yes.
She opens the movie in whiteface, for fuck's sake. Like, she's kind of zebra painted, and it's like up against a background of some kind of headless statue, like a Stonehenge kind of thing. And then she's got wire cones on all of her naughty bits. And it's just, it's the most bizarre thing. And there's a great moment when she finishes where there's just silence in that room, and then people kind of start slowly clapping, and one of our heroes decides, yeah, that's the one we got to get, because
that's the one we take to a frat party.
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't think you've thought this all the way through. And again, with the whole not explaining much to the audience, there's, when he goes in her dressing room, there's a lot of Egyptian artwork, and you get the sense immediately, like, oh, she's an Egyptian vampire, which
she's really old.
She's really old, which is funny because Dusk Till Dawn plays with that too. The whole idea of, you know, it being that kind of like an ancient culture, but not, you know, not where vampires are traditionally centered. It's not, you know, Transylvania. Europe.
Bright Night does the same thing by making them a Mediterranean breed of vampires.
Yeah. So it's really interesting how much they tell you without telling you anything. And that is epitomized in the fact that I think Grace Jones has about 5 lines in the entire movie. Like, she says very little. In fact, she is the big draw of the film. She's on all the posters.
She's the big bad.
she maybe has 10 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
That's what was fascinating to me, is that, and in no movie did I ever expect Getty Watanabe to have more screen time and dialogue than Grace Jones.
And she is, for those that haven't caught on yet, she's the master vampire.
Yes. Yeah.
She is the big boss.
She is the vamp.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, she's controlling this whole horde of not only vampire strippers, but, you know, vampire club workers and
thralls.
And one of the great things about this movie is how it messes with your expectations. There's a great moment when they first arrive in the town. They're at this shitty little diner, and they run afoul of these very, very pale, completely like albino group of weirdos. And you know this is a vampire movie, so your first instinct immediately when you see this gang is, oh, because they don't show up, and they make such a big deal out of it. And again, this whole vaudeville thing, the two guys are talking like, well, it's the After Dark Club. It says it opens after dark. Well, when is dark? I don't know. Is it dark now? Because if it's dark now, then it's a second from now. So they're going through almost this who's on first bit, but what they're really doing is establishing like the sun has gone down. And then as soon as they're done with that bit, these people stroll in. And it's after you've seen the diner, the chef / head waiter change into a priest's robe and go to flip the sign to close. And it says that it closes at dark. And all of these things happen right before these guys walk in. It's very subtle the way it's done. That, the way they're dressed, the way they look, you assume that these are the vampires. These are the, or at least part of the thrall. They're not at all.
No.
They're just weirdos. In fact, they're kind of like the lesser of two evils in this town. And I really like the way all throughout this movie that it plays with, like, it's very much a crowd-pleasing genre film, but at the same time, it's doing some really clever things.
Yeah.
Like, no, this, they took some care with this script for sure.
Yeah, no, that's the thing about this movie that needs to be hammered home, is this is not stupid, cheesy genre fare. It has fun, and it does a couple of goofy things deliberately to entertain. Particularly, we'll get to the ending and one of the greatest death scenes of all time.
Yep.
But on top of that, it just is a very clever, very smart movie that wanted to play around with vampires and do something new and fresh in 1986. And it holds up. Nobody has done this movie again. Like, we talk about what Dusk Till Dawn does, but From Dusk Till Dawn has a very different aesthetic and
a different tone.
It has a different tone and a different plot. It just revolves around the same concept.
I would even put those two films in. This is what's crazy, is despite how much From Dusk Till Dawn borrowed from this movie, they're not even in the same genre.
No, like, not really.
Vamp is a comedy.
No, I would watch this back to back with Near Dark.
Yeah,
before I'd watch it back to back with From Dusk Till Dawn.
I would watch it again. I'm beating a dead horse, but I would definitely watch this back to back with Night of the Creeps, because you could almost imagine that the college that they leave from at the beginning of the movie is Corman University from Night of the Creeps. It just feels like another story about two guys, you know, desperate to impress a frat, going, you know, and getting into trouble because of, you know, a frat that they're trying to get into. And this just happens to be vampires, where Night of the Creeps was, you know, zombie aliens.
And you know what's awesome?
What's that?
I will bet money. We will never be able to find out for sure, but I would bet money that this played back to back with Night of the Creeps in a at a drive-in in the 80s.
Oh, it has to.
They came out the same year. Same summer.
Holy shit.
They came out like weeks apart from one another.
That is crazy.
Of course, those two movies had to have played at a drive-in. And Vamp is PG-13, isn't it? Isn't that the thing about Vamp?
It definitely feels like 80s. I don't even know if it's PG. This would have been right after the whole like inception of PG-13.
I want to say that it was PG-13. I'm checking that out again, because I did see this in a theater. Like, I paid money and walked into a movie theater to see it.
Well, you know what's crazy about it is it takes place in a strip club. You do see some boob, but it's not as gratuitous as you would expect a movie set in a strip club to be. And right up until the finale, it's not really violent either.
No.
Like, there's very little, like, the scene where, you know, one of our heroes unfortunately falls prey to Katrina. is it's done with a certain amount of look at us and look at our practical effects. So, I mean, they do kind of linger on the wound a little bit, but less in a gross out way and more on a, hey, we paid for practical effects. Check out this practical effect. And I actually really enjoyed the design of Grace Jones's. Like, there's a couple of different versions or affectations or, I guess, steps along her metamorphosis trail where she's actually in several different costumes and several different levels of makeup effect throughout the course of this movie. And I think they're all pretty imaginative and pretty striking. Like, they do a lot of really great work with the effects that you see. But again, it's not a particularly violent movie. And that is supported entirely by the structure of the story and by one of the most clever things about this script, which is that the way this club operates, and you really have to be paying attention to what's being said by the MCs and by the bartenders throughout the course of the night. But if you pay attention, you understand exactly how this vampire plot works, where what they're doing is they're inviting single guys into the bar and charging them only a dollar to drink all night long. So these guys are getting shit-faced drunk.
Yep.
And then every once in a while, the MC will go up to somebody who's passed out and say, anybody want to claim this lush? And then, no? Okay, and the bouncer takes them out. If you were at this bar, if you were at this strip club, none of this would raise any alarm bells. But the thing you learn slowly throughout the course of the movie is these guys aren't passed out drunk. They've been fed upon by the stripper they were with, and they just leave them at the table, and the bouncer, quote, takes them outside, is really just tossing them in a dumpster. It's such kind of a perfect system.
Yeah.
And these guys just disappear and nobody notices because it's the shitty part of town that is completely abandoned. I think we mentioned when we talked about what was the film that you recommended with had John Cusack and as this crazy like food pirate guy?
Roadside Profits.
Yeah, it's kind of like Roadside Profits where you feel like there used to be a place where people were, it was populated by people, but they left the planet. That's how this part of this part of town feels. Yeah. So yeah, it's like it completely makes sense that they would just disappear.
Apparently, this was actually rated R.
Really?
So my parents, at the tender age of 11, took me to a movie theater.
That's a mistake.
To go see this.
Irresponsible on their part, but I'm glad they did.
I might be thinking Fright Night 2 that was PG-13.
Which would make sense, because I think that came out in like... Well, no, because the first one was 85, so it couldn't have been earlier than this. Fright Night 2 came out.
No, again, these were all movies that I was watching in the movie theater at the time.
Right.
But yeah, this one had to have played. With I know
there had to have been a double feature.
Someone's gonna send me a picture from their local newspaper from summer of 86 that shows that double feature, and it will just fill me with so much squee.
And if that didn't happen in your town, you should make it happen now.
Oh yes, this is that would be a really, really. I hadn't even put those two movies together.
Well, and the other thing is that in both of those movies, the two male leads are incredibly likable. Like, I know we talked about these two guys kind of being turbo douches, and they are. They're, again, Tom Cruise and Rain Man, but there is something very likable about them. Like, you do root for them, and when one of them ends up getting killed, I remember, like, sitting and watching this movie and being like, oh, man, I like that guy. That sucks that he's dead. How often do you feel that in a horror movie?
Yeah, no, it's these characters, the character creation here is really fantastic. The waitress, for fuck's
sake. Yeah.
Allison
/ Amaretto.
Yeah, such an adorable, lovable concept for a romantic attachment.
Played by Michelle Pfeiffer's younger sister, Dee Dee. That's a truth fact.
Oh, yep. I didn't know that was Michelle Pfeiffer's younger sister.
Dee Dee Pfeiffer is the younger sister of Michelle Pfeiffer. That's who plays this character who...
That is adorable.
Very adorable. And they even... Again, like, this movie is not cutting any corners because they've written a waitress at a strip club to still be a girl next door.
Yeah.
And it's such an amazing thing that they pull off. I mean, that is a stunt that I can't believe they pulled off, but they did it entirely well.
Well, it's such a great concept by having her recognize him and be playing the game all night. Like, you know, come on, you don't recognize me. And this whole concept that here's this moment she had with this guy when they were in junior high that has been the pinnacle of her young life, of just the height of romance. And now this guy's walked back into her life and she feels like it's karma, it's fate. It's like, here it is. This is why I ended up in this shitty, you know, in the shitty job at this shitty fucking bar, mm-hmm. was to bring me back together with the guy who gave me the most romantic night of my life. Is just such a charming character affectation. And it just makes you adore her. Every time she comes onto screen, the movie kind of lights up and gets adorable. So by the time you're running with her through the sewers in the third act, you are invested as hell with, in a character that they also, you know, this is one of the other things I think is cool about this movie. This movie's really sex positive.
Like it is, yeah.
Like she's not ashamed to be working in a fucking strip club.
Yeah.
And they never really shame anybody for working in a strip club. Like the people they really downplay in this movie are the sleazeball thralls who are helping vampires. Like the fact that they're working in a strip club is just, you know, a side thing. And it's very much like what they do in Deadpool.
Yeah.
Where it's just, this strip club is not treated as an awful thing to do for a living. Like when you're surrounded by characters that actively kill people for their living, stripping is just a thing that happens.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually pretty cool. And I think that probably has something to do with Grace Jones's influence.
Well, and that would explain the very arty nature of her dance.
Yeah. Well, and she was a very sex positive person in particularly in the 80s. So that these are things that don't surprise me.
And again, a similarity to Night of the Creeps. And we really can't claim that one took from the other considering they came out the same summer.
No.
But it's just interesting that another similarity they share is that when one of the characters, you know, one of the two leads falls victim to the supernatural baddie of the movie, like you do feel something. Like you and then, you know, the other friend is clearly torn up about it and trying to figure out what happened, and it just was like this weird overlay.
Like if this movie borrows from anything, I feel that in the third act it borrows just a bit from American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
The supernatural best friend.
Yes.
Him showing back up as a vampire. And the way he does it, it's in that way of like, dude, we got to break this curse. Fuck this. It's not the, you think it's the concept of, oh no, now I have to kill my friend because he's going to try to kill me. He's like, no, dude, I'm a vampire. This fucking sucks. This isn't what I wanted to have happen.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't steal that. It just kind of borrows elements of that and does that's a really cool scene.
Yeah. And there's a really great piece of dialogue too. I mean, when he first comes back, you think, oh, perhaps he says it was just a joke. You start to think maybe it's somebody in disguise, maybe like some kind of spell that's being cast. And then you slowly start to see him turn into a vampire. And he's got this great line where he says that, he can't control the hunger, and he says, you know, I'm starving, and he says to his friend AJ, like, you carry my next meal with you around in your veins. I love you. He literally says, I love you, but all I can see right now is food, which is such a great line because, again, like, these are two guys who we've established are kind of like con artists. They're very cocky, but you get the sense that they are really close friends, and you buy their relationship between the two of them. So, I mean, it's complicated, and it at no point did it need to be this complicated. At no point did anyone force the filmmakers, the screenwriters, to put this much care into making these characters. But that's exactly why this movie, even watched for the first time now, is so appealing and really draws you in. And I think it's a real testament to the screenwriter / director, who, by the way, I was really surprised to find out who the screenwriter / director was. Because the story, or at least was co-written, and then the film directed by Richard Wenk, who works a lot right now with Antoine Fuqua.
Yeah.
He's a guy who you might not recognize too much of what he's directed, but, I mean, if you look at the movies he's written are things like 16 Blocks, The Equalizer, and then he's also written The Magnificent Seven, for Antoine Fuqua. So, I mean, this is a guy who's he's also wrote the screenplay for the new Jack Reacher movie, Never Go Back. So a guy who's really interesting and his stuff is really good. And it's surprising to me that I feel like he's more known for the things he's done as of, you know, the late 2000s than for the stuff he did in the 80s. Like, you don't see that too often where someone kind of tried but failed to make something happen in the 80s and then got a resurgence, you know, almost 30 years later. That's not something you see terribly often.
No, but that's something I actually talk about with a lot of folks, especially, you know, people who want to be writers. It's one of the great things about being a writer is that you play by a completely different set of rules than everyone else in the industry. Mm-hmm. Because you get better as you get older. Being an old writer is actually a coveted thing. It is not something that, oh, you didn't hit, so your mm-hmm. time has passed. No, as a wise man once said to me, you can always write yourself out of writer jail. Like, it's the one career where you can just go into your office and write something so good that everybody goes, ah, okay, you can come out of the box now.
Interesting.
We're going to make this movie. Like, if you... You know, whether you do something, I mean, think of some of the greatest writers in history and the awful human beings they were. But why do we still read their stuff, even if they were offensive and terrible human beings? It's like, because they were really good and what they wrote is fascinating. And sometimes broken people make great writers. So here's this guy that tried to make it as a writer director in the 80s and descended into trash. And the last movie he directed was in 2002. And that's it. Your career's over. You're not taking meetings anymore. Nobody's regarding you as a great director, but shit. It doesn't cost anything to write a script except your time. And if you've got your time, you write it and you sell and you write movies like 16 Blocks, which mm-hmm. is a great script. That movie is not a great movie. I think that's a movie we should visit.
I remember liking it at some point when it came out.
Yeah, no, but the performances in it are just so weird. If you remember, but as a script, that's a great fucking script. It's like, holy shit. And then he's written great stuff like The Equalizer, which is really fucking
so good.
You and I are mad in love with that movie. Everyone else is like, really? And we're like, fuck you. That's a Denzel Washington film. If ever I fucking saw one.
Brought to you by Home Depot.
So the fact
your one-stop shop for murder.
The movie that you and I are fucking salivating over, fucking Magnificent Seven. Holy
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm super excited about that Jack Reacher sequel, too, because that first one was great.
Jack Reacher's a surprisingly interesting film.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at it as a superhero film, as opposed to just a spy film, as most people mm-hmm. would be like, oh, this is another one of those Bourne Identity. No, no, no. Think of it structurally as a superhero. Jack Reacher is a superhero.
Yeah.
And that's who he is. He just doesn't have any magical powers.
It's the Short Knight Returns.
He's you know, he's
don't count on those pity laughs here, guys. You won't get them.
You know, in the 90s, he was a lot of our picks for Wolverine for just that reason. Like, he was on everybody's wish list to play Wolverine.
We're like, well, if Bob Hoskins is gonna pass, then absolutely it should be Tom Cruise.
Yeah, so needless to say, yeah, no, Wenk is such an interesting dude.
Yeah.
And you see the sharpness in his writing here. And that carries through to an entire career. So it shouldn't be surprising, but because he's not somebody whose name everybody knows and who's one of those, you know, kind of tradesmen, you know, journeyman, longtime writers.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody that in context of his career makes so much more sense. But here we're talking about a movie that they made for $3 million, only made $4 million.
Yeah, not considered a hit by any stretch of the imagination. And it kind of disappeared. Like, it kind of just vanished from the face of the earth. Like, I've never really heard anybody talk about it. I don't see articles coming out to remind people what a great film it is. You know, I never see this movie come up in any conversation.
No, and it doesn't. And it's one of those things that I've brought up a couple of times to folks in talking about those 80s vampire movies, but it's not one I felt strongly enough about to mention when we did our bit on 80s vampire movies. And so when I was going through the list, I was like, oh, I remember really liking that, but I just didn't remember enough of it to competently bring it up. So I sat down and rewatched it. I'm like, oh, fuck yes. I hope Brian loves this because I want to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
This right here is exactly what I love doing, why I love doing Junk Food Cinema, is I love being able to go back and revisit these things that I may not have seen in 30 fucking years. Like, maybe I rented this on VHS the next year and watched it again, but I'm not certain that I did. I think the only time I had ever seen this movie until recently was when I hopped on, went and saw it in a movie theater. Like, it's that kind of a movie. And a lot of those movies you go back and revisit. I remember one that came out at a similar time was a movie called Starship, which was a 1980s sci-fi movie. And I went back and revisited that a few years ago and going, oh, I remember loving this movie when I saw it in a theater, but never watched it again. And rewatched it and went, oh yeah, 10-year-old me loved this.
10-year-old you also really just loved that song from the end of Mannequin.
Yeah.
So you were really into Starship.
You know what?
So
you say that. That is Mannequin is tied into my head with the movie, because Starship should have had a soundtrack by Starship, but it did not, because it was
by that rationale the movie Airplane should have had a soundtrack by Jefferson Airplane.
That would have been fucking great. So this movie is one of those that just, wow, does it hold up, and wow, has time been kind to it. And I think it's one of those movies I hope everybody else starts chatting about again and rewatching again.
Yeah.
Like what happened when we talked about Your Hunter from the Future, where all of a sudden all our friends started making jokes about Your Hunter from the Future and started rewatching it and going, oh, hey, shit, yeah, this was fun. And then all of a sudden all the film critics in our circle are talking about it. And then a handful of our friends from LA are just like, why the fuck is everybody talking about Your again? Like, how did that become a thing for 5 minutes? I would love it if that happened with Vamp, where everybody's like, all right, fuck it, let's watch Vamp.
You know what I call that? I call that us farting in the word cloud.
Farting in
the word cloud, because you have the word cloud of what everyone's talking about on Twitter, and then all of a sudden comes this little, like, what the fuck is that? Why is Your Hunter from the Future making its way in here? What is happening?
What is happening? And I hope Vamp sees a resurgence, because, man, Vamp is cool.
And it's got this really unexpected empathetic loneliness to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's the things that the club manager says, you can tell he used to be like an old Vegas lounge lizard type of guy, and he's something happened where now
he has dreams.
He's chained to these vampire people, and it's clear that that's not where his life wanted to go.
That death scene is poignant.
Yeah.
Like, when they're just sitting there in the fire and they're like, well, that's it.
Yeah.
That's great. But we have not yet talked about how amazing Grace Jones' death is in this fucking
movie. You know what? I remember you saying to me before I watched it, you said, be on the lookout for something that happens in this movie that is going to add context to a meme that you've seen online.
Yeah.
And we're getting to the end of the movie. I'm like, and I remember right before it happened, I thought, it's like, didn't Cargill say something about a meme would be explained by this? I haven't seen anything. And then almost before I finished the sentence, it happened.
And she bursts into flames. She's a skeleton.
Yes.
She flips him the bird.
Yeah, skeletal finger, middle finger goes up, and then she drops dead. And I was like, yep.
And then
that's, I've seen that.
The body, and you're like, I've seen that gif.
I have.
I've fucking seen that gif.
And I remember thinking when I saw the gif, like, huh, I'd really like to watch that movie and figure out where that came from. But I never, you know, did the due diligence of figuring that out.
How great is it when something like that that's become a meme is actually attached to a really cool fucking movie that makes that meme even better?
Yeah. And again, I think it's Grace Jones's 15th costume change of the movie by the time we get to that point. And again, she's got so many weird outfits and so many varying degrees of transformation throughout this film that she's really, and I think this is all part and parcel of the movie understanding Grace Jones's, like, the zeitgeist of Grace, the zeitgeist of why Grace Jones was popular, because they make her, they do her up in such a way that you can't not look at her. Like, you can't look at anything but her when she's on the screen.
That's the thing, is this movie capitalizes on her charisma, her natural charisma, in a way that vampires are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And when you see great vampire performances, like we talked about last week with Colin Farrell, someone who shows that charisma, someone, Chris Sarandon from the original Fright Night has that charisma. Then you see other vampires in vampire movies who are supposed to be charismatic, and you're like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, what's so alluring about this? Is one of the things that they actually did right in the Twilight movies, is at the very least, every vampire in that fucking movie is fucking beautiful, even the ugly ones. Like,
I was with you for so long. I was with you. I was going down the primrose path with you, and then you
said something nice about a movie series that we've kicked.
I don't know that just because you got glitter all over your face makes you visually interesting.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, like, the glitter is only in the light. Like, that's the, like, everyone, all those vampires are really good looking and feel charismatic. Their dialogue, the things coming out of their mouth, are terrible, but man, is that a pretty cast to look at. And yeah. Man, do you see why girls would be fawning over Pattinson in that movie?
But here's my counter argument to that, and why, again, I think this is a more interesting take. It's like, yeah, they're pretty, but I don't even necessarily myself consider Grace Jones to be attractive. So she doesn't exist in the realm of pretty for me, and yet she's still something I can't stop looking at in this movie, which I think is a far more fascinating aesthetic, is that I'm not...
I think it's done better here.
I'm not drawn to her because I think she's attractive. I'm drawn to her because they won't let me look at anything else. Like, the way she's made up and the way she just looks naturally, and you're right, the way she does... She commands a lot of attention in this movie, despite the fact that they apparently gave all of her lines irresponsibly to Getty Watanabe, who should not say more than three or four things in a movie, as it turns out. She is still able to completely draw you in, saying very little. And I think that's actually one of the only things that didn't work for me in this movie, is Watanabe works much better, unfortunately, as a stereotype in a John Hughes movie, than as a character who speaks at length, because I got real tired of him real quick. And I think it's just because, as much as he is also a mainstay of the 80s, he's not a very good actor.
No, but the thing is he nails exactly what he's supposed to nail. You're supposed to be annoyed by him. You're supposed to...
Well, then,
to
mission accomplished.
You're not supposed to feel real pity for this guy. You're supposed to realize why our douche nozzle protagonist wouldn't ever want to hang out with him if he didn't have a car.
It's true. It's true. And he does that well, but he might do that a little too well. Maybe he's too good of an actor then. Maybe that's the actual criticism I have here.
Hey, where are we going?
Doesn't matter. What counts is that you're my buddy.
I love the journey that these characters are on throughout this movie, which, you know, normally when you talk about a cult 80s horror film, you're hanging around for the bloodshed. You're hanging around to see the inventive deaths. You're hanging around for the carnage. I was hanging around to see where this night was going to end. I was hanging around to see, there's so many, like, I wanted to, around another corner, there might be an interesting character like the orphan little girl who you think is in peril and then leaps up and rips some guy's throat out. Like, there's so many things, like, every alley of this jerkwater town, this largely abandoned, you know, set of tenements and brick faces, like, I wanted to spend more time there. I wanted to see what was waiting around the next corner, and that's not something you get from horror movies a lot of time. And again, why I think this movie exists far more in the comedy realm is because that's really what drives the film. It's not the horde of vampires. It's not the gore. I mean, there's very little gore in this movie. It's just about that one night journey that these two characters are on, and us wanting to know how it's going to end. And it's got an almost Dead Heat type ending, where it's just like, okay, well, you're dead. What do we do now? And he's just like, oh, I'll go to night school, or, you know, like, I'll enroll in some evening courses. I'll get a graveyard shift job. And he's just basically following them back home under the ground as they, you know, walk home and Volare plays, which is a great callback to the fact that the two guys who run the club are you know, guys who wanted, who he talks about all the acts that used to come in that club, and it's like, I want to see the movie about what this place used to be and how Grace Jones took it over. And it's just, there's so much that feels fully realized about the town where this takes place, and you can tell it has a history that exists long before the first reel of this movie, and it's just so fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more, and I would put this, I would definitely add this to the rotation that I normally go to for 80s vampires, with Near Dark, with Fright Night, with you know, what are some of the other ones we mentioned during our show? Like, I would put this in the same category as all of the best 80s vampire movies. And I think, again, I think it's just, it's almost like this weird little independent film. Like, it just, it's so much about it that feels a lot smarter and a lot more fleshed out than it needed to be, but I'm so glad that they took the time and care to put that effort into it.
Yep. And I'm so happy that you loved it.
I did. I really, like, I'm angry at myself that I didn't watch this sooner. Like, this should have been one of the movies I discovered right off the bat, you know, when I moved here, but...
Well, if we discover all the great ones, then what the fuck is the point of this show?
Ah.
It's really, like, we talk about it every once in a while, but really... We don't do this because we need people to listen to our voice and hear our opinions. We do this because it's a
We do it because it's
a really great excuse to force ourselves to watch particular movies under a timeline and then process them and then talk with them with folks like you who fucking get it as well. This is one of those movies that, in going through the summer of 86 again, I was so happy to revisit, and so much so I almost watched it again this afternoon. I'll probably watch it again later tonight.
I'm definitely watching this again within the next couple days. That is absolutely something that's happening.
Did you ever have one of those nights?
Which brings us to the junk food pairing, which I feel like had to be an alcoholic beverage, because, again, the central conceit of this movie is that they are slowly... getting all of these single wayward guys so drunk that they can be fed upon and disappear without anyone noticing. Who wants to claim this lush? It's a great mechanic that I've never seen before in a vampire film. So I was very impressed with that. And I feel like if you're going to drink something at a vampire bar, what else would you drink?
Come on.
But absinthe.
You really, what?
But absinthe.
Oh,
the vamp! What were you thinking?
Oh, I thought you were gonna go for the full on pun and
the Bloody Mary.
Yeah,
come on. Well, no, didn't think
you
of
were
it.
You were about to say I. You,
I'm better than I didn't
no,
think of
you're
that.
Not.
I didn't think of that.
It was the first thing that came to you. I didn't even need to say it. You're like Bloody Mary. Oh yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple scenes in this movie where the drinks
absinthe,
that are
no absinthe. I think is the perfect junk food pairing for this movie, especially since it's a forgotten film.
That's true. And not only that, but like when the actual DVD release of this movie, the only one that I'm aware of, comes in an alcoholic six-pack box, you know, cover art, like you have to go with alcoholic. And if you're going to drink with a vampire, they're going to drink absinthe. That's just the way it works. Thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode. Hope you have enjoyed it. And I hope that you, if you haven't seen it, you will track down and watch Vamp. It is one of my stronger recommendations and one of the better discoveries that I've made for myself in the course of doing this show. So definitely track that down, and definitely consider following us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and liking the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Go to iTunes, 5-star ratings, leave us reviews. We always like to see those. I'd like to see what people think and who's listening. That's really awesome. And if you have a few extra shekels to throw into the hat, definitely consider becoming a pledging to us on Patreon. We have hit our goal of $200 an episode, which means that we'll soon, once we kind of get through the summer of 86 series that we're on right now, we'll start doing a few, we'll be peppering in for patrons exclusively reviews of movies that are still in theaters that we might consider to be junk food worthy. So that'll be a lot of fun. And we want to keep that growing as much as possible. So again, thank you very much for doing that. Please tell everyone you know about it. That'd be great. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury. You can also like my page on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. So we're going to wrap this show up. I want to give you one piece of advice. Always, always, always claim your lushes.